Hey, Dirty Moderates, this is our Toast to Democracy, our After Dark series. We're excited to have episode number two for you with somebody I think we can have a After Dark, wide-ranging, all-encompassing conversation with. Somebody who I've followed for a long time before I was even in this game, the great Noah Rothman is here. Associate editor, commentary, writes prolifically for National Review. A really incisive critic, I would say, of the left and its excesses. I'd say you're kind of a center right guy. Is that fair?
Depends on how you characterize me. I never thought of myself as center right before the Trump era. I was actually pretty closer to the conservative right. Just to illustrate, how far right I am. No longer with commentary. Used to be with commentary. Now I'm over.
You're no longer with commentary. I did not know that.
Now I'm a senior writer at National Review. That's why it's prolific.
It is. Well, I love it.
That's the day job.
So commentary isn't right. I mean, commentary is a redoubt of conservative thought. I mean,
it is, but it didn't used to be. In its history, it was founded to be more of a journal explaining Israel to America and America to Israel. Right. But it was originally a product of the American Jewish Committee, and it had no partisan leanings. Indeed, if it had any, it was more to the left because that's where the American Jewish community was.
Right.
It became more of a conservative journal with the onset of neoconservatism's drift toward foreign policy and away from domestic policy.
Right.
So this is generally, I've always considered myself on the conservative right. It's just that the right is no longer very conservative.
No, and they're not conservative at all. They're sort of anti-intellectual populists, really. I mean, they without real, and it saddens me. It gives me, I'm a total independent. I support both parties as needed. I was raised a Democrat, but I haven't been a Democrat for 5 years, but I've always felt closer in foreign policy to the conservative movement. And certainly I'm a limited government guy, all things considered. So I consider myself centered. I'm just much more libertarian social issues than I think a lot of the right is, which is why your book is so interesting, because the right, Noah's book, which it came out in 2022, but we're going to talk about a lot of things here. The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against Progressives' War on Fun. I love it because it used to be the right? The scolding, sanctimonious right that yucked our yum and had sticks up their ass, basically, you know? And although Tipper Gore did go after rock lyrics and she wasn't on the right and all that, or rap lyrics or whatever. But that was
a conservative ethos. That was a conservative philosophy.
Right. Right. And for those that don't know we have a lot of geeks who listen to the show, Al Gore was elected to the House in the 70s and pretty much even through part of his Senate tenure, he was pro-life and Tipper was rather culturally conservative. So, it was the old Democratic Party. It was a different, a lot of people don't know that. But to your book, listen, progressives have killed fun. I mean, let's face it, but the book does something I love because it really goes into the heart of a lot of the sort of cultural political nexus. I mean, it's sort of outside politics, but it can't be completely outside politics because it's affecting our politics. But you're looking at comedy and food and all these cultural institutions, which have been seized by this crazy mindset, call it wokeness, call it progressivism. I call it just fucking insanity. But your book does a really, really intellectual job of giving us who the Puritans were and how that ethos, right, which I think shapes America right, left, center, and otherwise in a big way. So I just want to start with that, and we're going to talk about a lot of things. What was the motivation, really, for you to write this? Like, what was the tipping point?
Well, to be honest, both of my books, The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Up Against Progressives' War on Fun, and Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America, were incepted for entirely selfish reasons. I just wanted to write about something that wasn't the day-to-day of politics, because the day-to-day of politics was horrible. And one of the, just really soul-crushing. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book in particular is because I would be doing things, I'd be writing about things outside the spectrum of politics, or what should be outside the spectrum of politics, cultural, as you said, cultural fare, food, entertainment, sports, sex, half a dozen things that should exist outside of a political milieu, but have been subsumed into it with the drift of the progressive movement towards a more moralistic ideal of how society should construct itself. Mm-hmm. As you said, it was mostly the right wing in the age, you know, the time in which we grew up, that with their keen senses of moral propriety could discern in seemingly innocent cultural fare the sort of thing that would corrupt you, degrade society around you. And they were rather preoccupied with this sort of thing in ways that I found to be a turnoff at the time and still kind of do. And it was the progressive movement, the left, that was more live and let live, far more accepting and tolerant of different standards, different social standards. And that sort of flipped in the last couple of years. And now we have progressives identify far more with the idea of being able to discern moral degrading influences in cultural affairs. So we have entertainment companies that are introducing like really didactic narratives into entertainment products that take you out of the product, that actually ruin the product and force you to suspend disbelief. But it imparts the message that they think you need to have because they don't really trust you to see it for yourself. Comedians who emphasize the pain that they had to go through in order for you to have something as trite and frivolous as a laugh. Sports broadcasters.
It's so ridiculous. Not what you're saying.
Racial digressions into it. Like it is ridiculous and it takes you out of the moment. But the whole idea is to take you out of the moment. It is to deprive you of the opportunity to, for a minute, stop thinking about the horrible environment in which we live in and your obligation, your moral obligation to make whatever small contributions you can to perfect it. This is a very puritanical ideal. This is not a metaphor. I'm actually saying that these people are the derivatives of a puritanical movement in this country because progressivism emerged from the ashes of the Puritan experiment in mainline Protestant New England.
Right.
And it has, you know, we're all heirs to this tradition, right and left.
Yep.
But in a sort of, you know, it's more pronounced in some eras on the right, more pronounced in some eras on the left. And we're in the middle of one where it is coming back to the fore on the left. The left doesn't recognize it. They reject the label. But hopefully this shows them what they are.
Well, you know, you and I talking before this show about how people have zero education on who the Puritans were. They just know the term. And those that are familiar with it in a passing way, in my experience, just tend to associate it with Puritans were prudes about sex. That's kind of all they know. They don't know the whole concept of sin and regeneration. And
but that's a misnomer. I mean, that's a misconception. What they're thinking of are Victorian standards.
That's a 19th century concept.
Very much. That's what we think of when we think of the blue-nosed, prudish Puritan. We're thinking of Victorians and Victorian ethos. That's not really progressive, or not really Puritanism, but it is modern puritanical progressivism.
No, that's right. I mean, one of the things that I think is I wanted to do when I thinking about your book was going back to something that I had written a while ago in a paper, which is very relevant because this ties into what you're writing. What people, what your book does so well is that you do it in the Fear of God chapter, the evil of banality, you call it. You isolate something that's very, very important. It's actually been very endemic to utopian leftist Marxist thought, right? The whole like I think intellectual Achilles heel of that whole movement is they believe the more laws you pass, the more social engineering you do, we can perfect the world in a legal political sense. That's been the left's right. If we only had universal healthcare, if we only had a Green New Deal, if we, you know, it, but then even when you get that, life is still imperfect and there's a homeless guy there and he only has two shoes and he should have three. So we have to have a law. And I live in California where literally that goes on. We have gender neutral toy stores. Everything is legislated. Parking signs, you need a lawyer to interpret them because you've probably been out here and know. Because everything is over legislated. But the Puritans, right? Also, right? Their whole concept was America was a new Jerusalem or new Zion. And there was this Puritans repeatedly invoked a Jeremiah, a lament about how America was the new Israel, but it would have to live up to that, right? It would constantly be sinning and therefore it'd have to go back to square one and regenerate. So I'm reading what I wrote because I did a lot of studies on this in grad school and it's your book, you know, it says, for if the Puritans repeatedly invoked a Jeremiah, which cast America as the new Israel and exalted among nations, this idealization framed its exhortative, sorry to be too academic, politics in terms of responsibility, but mainly through a fear of sin and punishment. If American uniqueness entailed a special covenant with God, A breach of this righteous compact resulted in swift retribution. As such, this powerful mythos essentially ensured we'd always be post-lapsarian, right? Bathing in sin all the time, since Puritans often cast aside any mutual obligations and actually prioritize their own individualism over community. Accordingly, this Jeremiah prophesied a regenerative future that could ever be redeemed, forever be redeemed by what it promised to reject: selfishness, callousness, idleness, and luxury. I wrote that in a paper. Your book talks literally about idleness, anxious introspection, sin. Hey, right? I said
luxury.
I gotta get
yeah, and the sin of sacrificing austerity. Yeah,
of austerity.
That you better than I did.
that's and I. No. I mean, this I told you I'm an American grad student in this, but not my focus actually wasn't early American thought, but I was analyzing literature through it. But you think about that because that is exactly what your book is talking about how the idea that the world needs to be perfected, right? But that you can't ever be idle and not be doing the work, because then you're violating the breach, and not with God, but with this secular religion known as wokeness or progressivism. I mean, the terms become so overused.
Well,
but
Perry Miller described Puritanism not as a religious theory or right. a theological theory, but a, quote, program for society. It was a way of life. A
holistic, errand into the wilderness.
Holistic right. wilderness. Yeah, and so the book is arranged around virtues for a reason. All the chapters are actually unimpeachable virtues: piety, prudence, austerity. You mentioned fear of God, temperance, and order, harmony right. in a society. Right. All of these things are great in the abstract. Their excesses are what I focus on, because they've manifested in ways that are obviously to the trained eye, an right. expression of the effort to create a utopian ideal, a holistic society in which all engines are and all oars are rowing in the same direction. All engines are harnessed towards one goal, which is the establishment of the new Zion for Puritans. For progressives, it is the advancement of the progressive project. And we see the policing of sin against that covenant in much the same fashion as we did in the late 17th century. We see efforts to police, for example, I opened one of the first chapters with an effort to condemn a convenience store owner, or rather just a restaurateur, whose child, when she was a child, apparently used racial epithets online. And the outcry was such that they had that people who held the lease for the store withdrew it. And the sin that they were policing there was the careless parentage of a willful daughter. I don't know how else to describe it. Likewise, an LA Galaxy soccer player who lost his position on the team because his wife was similarly offensive online. His association with a woman of low repute was sufficient to justify his condemnation. Chaos in the Poetry Foundation, resignations over these sorts of things that would otherwise, just be water under the bridge and relatively unnoticed. It is all an effort to police society, perfect society, and create a social covenant around which everyone is directed towards the same puritanical ideal of sort of a mainline view of how society should organize itself and the ideals that society should hold. It's not a particularly American view. I mean, it's puritanical insofar as Puritanism is American. Mm. But that idea of a puritanical social covenant did not survive very long. The people who were a part of it lived to see it degrade out, fall out from under them. In fact, they lamented the death of the Puritan experiment in their lifetimes. It's only that it has such a long life insofar as the people who were involved in it were extremely literate and had no other vocation other than to write, because just about every other form of every other pastime was forbidden. So they left a profound record of how they viewed life. And one of the ways in which they organized the society was to condemn art that wasn't useful. And we see this throughout the book. It's that artistic endeavors, whatever they may be, have to serve a particular purpose, and the purpose primarily is as a record for posterity. So in the Puritan world, you can get exceptions for being a headstone maker or a furniture crafter or a drawing portraiture, because these were records for posterity. They served a purpose. Art for art's sake is idle, and idleness is a sin, and the devil's tool indeed. So that when you have artistic endeavors today that do not impart a message, that do not guide you towards the moral path as your betters perceive it to be, it's an idle work. It's a sinful work. which is why we see comedians emphasizing their pain and Disney shows ensuring that they have the proper mix of LGBTQ characters in there. And indeed, you know, attacks on, for example, the Netflix show Cobra Kai, because its cast didn't precisely mirror the population breakdown of the San Fernando Valley in the 2020 census. This was a real condemnation, but it is all designed, to advance one particular worldview, which is equality. And that's not a bad thing. It is in its successes where we see a profound disconnect with the rest of American society.
Yeah. I mean, I want to just read from your book because I just want people to hear it summed up as such. In the same way, the religious right could once be counted on to inveigh against all pursuits that did not contribute to the saving of souls, the progressive activist class regards activities that are not useful to their cause with contempt. There seems to be something special. I love this line. There seems to be something special about America that encourages this kind of zealotry, because it, here we are, right? You did say, right wing censoriousness does have a puritanical, more than a puritanical strain, but progressivism in New England grew out of Puritanism too. So it's all interwoven in this kind of American exceptionalist discourse that we use. And deploy for different ideological reasons, right?
Yeah, precisely. One of the things that I found most absurd when I was writing the chapter on austerity, by the way, deals with both sports and fashion,
right,
which are two things you probably wouldn't think would go together, but they do in the Puritan mind, insofar as they are both expressions of pride, sinful pride, athletic exhibition that is overly zealous and doesn't have any practical dimension in the Puritan world, like martial exercises, shooting and running and what have you. Mm-hmm. That stuff was okay, even though it was kind of looked down upon. It was okay. But anything else, especially things like football, the Puritan proto-football, was a prideful, sinful expression of zeal. And it was very bloody, and the Puritans did not approve of that sort of thing. And likewise, we see a similar effort to police that behavior today among progressive activists. And likewise, fashion, because in the Puritan world, there were sumptuary laws, laws that forced you to wear a particular uniform that conveyed your station. It was mostly built around class. But there were not a lot of class distinctions in the puritanical world because there wasn't a lot of income disparities. Today, however, there are. But most of the efforts to impose a uniform on you by progressive activists today are associated with the accidents of your birth, your race. So we have crusades to police the wearing of hoop earrings because that should be the exclusive provenance of Hispanic women. And right, you can't wear braids because that should be the exclusive provenance of African-American women. And, the effort to by a group called Diet Prada, which tried to, get Dolce & Gabbana in very serious trouble, punching way above their weight because of the sin that they had committed by with cultural mixing, cultural appropriation, they called it, with this advertising campaign that mixed Italian culinary tastes with Chinese cultural conventions because it was a Dolce & Gabbana show on mainland China. And then they sued. And here's what's really important. All this breaks down when the bottom line gets in trouble. Because when they sued that organization that was, really high on its hog, getting a lot of plaudits from the activist left for its activist crusades against this, against this particular organization, they just sort of melted away. And we see that across the spectrum. At the end of the book, I illustrate why that is with the tale of the phrase banned in Boston. Band of Boston used to describe actually things that were just too hot, too salacious for mainline Protestants in Boston. And they bodlerized books, they banned plays, they banned songs on the radio. It continued well into the 1920s. It was very successful for a time. What broke it down was the fact that eventually this became not just a warning against titillating entertainment, titillating fare. It was a really effective advertisement for it. So publishers actively tried to have their books banned in Boston, because that would increase sales everywhere else. So it becomes its own advertisement. The seeds of its destruction are sown by market forces.
Yes.
Because these people actually want to have these experiences. Americans want to have these experiences by and large. They're not the moral, preening, uptight sort that the activist class is catering to. And eventually that whole edifice collapses around the need to make a buck.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things in the book that you that you write about so well, and it made me think about how, you know, the evangelical right is the term you hear most often, or the religious right, but sort of the evangelizing of all these, of the values crowd, family values crowd. But left are evangelical progressives, because the work has to be sold and proselytized about and embarked upon. It's not something that can be, as you write, idle. I like this chapter, and you taught me about George McKenna, who I had not read. This paragraph, as American Puritanism blended with religious populism, American moralists emphasized individual conversion experiences and political activism as evidence of high-mindedness. Quote, individual piety was not enough, wrote George McKenna in the most comprehensive exploration of puritanical thought's impact on American politics, The Puritan Origins of American Patriotism. Quote, to be active in one's salvation also meant also to be active in the world, end quote. First of all, I don't know that book. I can't believe I was never assigned that book, but that sounds fascinating. But there is, right? I mean, think about it, right? You had, there is a notion of being a crusader for this. That's like you said, racial justice, basically economic fairness, equity, whatever you want to call the three components, and environmental protection. These things have to be, they're like your daily bread.
right? You brought up, yeah, absolutely. And you brought up doing the work earlier, mm-hmm. which has become this, or it may be a little passe now, but when I wrote it, it was a very in vogue phrase to demonstrate your commitment to your own re-education, marinating yourself in this ideal and espousing its values, mouthing them really. It didn't matter whether you believed them or not. Your input was neither solicited nor desired. It was about your subjecting yourself to this educational experience, often a painful educational experience that was often emphasized by its advocates. And this is about as Puritan as it gets, back in the late 17th century or early 18th century. Doing the work, as it were, the sweat on your brow, mm-hmm. the great works that you leave behind, was the only evidence of your visible saintliness. Visible mm-hmm. saintliness is a phrase to describe the condition in which you have achieved a level of education and theological education and theological commitment that you ascend to the church as a voting member. So this is essentially citizenship in Puritan New England. And we have a similar concept here, although it's far less statutory, insofar as your visible saintliness today is your willingness to endure the unendurable, to experience profound impositions and uncomfortable situations and do the work, as it were. Mm. And that is an expression of your zeal and your commitment to the cause, and therefore the justification for your ascent into full membership within the progressive milieu. So I absolutely see a direct parallels between these two things. Again, people think, like, is this a metaphor? Are you trying to, like, really make this really strained effort to, you know, craft this thread between these 300-year periods? No, I'm not. This is really direct to a degree that I myself was shocked when I began researching the thesis.
Well, right. I mean, also we're all underserved, and it's all to our detriment that, you know, the average, you know, American history class, even seventh grade or higher, starts with, oh, these English settlers and some Dutch came over. And by the way, this is how the country starts. We're arguing over the Constitution, you know, leaving out all those pre-constitutional years, which not only shaped the succeeding period, but it shaped where we are today. So nobody has a reference point for it, which is why your book is so valuable. But I was going to say that, the other thing that I think is so fascinating about the doing the work and the sort of scold of it all. So in my former life, I was a Broadway producer. That was where I was. And 2020 came along. Also, by the way, I think 2020 broke us. I think the George Floyd situation and that Trump Biden year broke the country. I don't think and COVID, of course, but just the confluence of events seemed to have left us in the most wacko place, even more wacko than we were. But I'm bringing up the theater to say that all during this, there was a movement that went around from artists of color or black artists. I can't remember what it was called now. We see you, white theater, And it was like this sign. Of course, all these people. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, yeah. All these people had to, not me, signing on to say that we're going to make changes and we're going to take this bastion of white supremacy and turn it into something. And I went, you know, bastion of white supremacy. You mean the gay Jewish theater that created America? That bastion of, you know, I'm sorry, I missed the memo on the Eastern European immigrants who people Tin Pan Alley and wrote the shows and the number of LGBT artists who make it hum every day. I'm sorry, I'm lost. I missed the period of theater history, which was run by the Anglo-Saxon establishment, you know, from right. And blue blood Brahmins. I mean, it's most so preposterous, this stuff, yeah. You know, but that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. And I spoke out against it. Then I'm not signing anybody's threat. Secondly, I'm not active in the theater, but and anyone who signs this, you're buying into a myth, by the way, that we have learned and we're going to talk about excludes Jews. And it's the Jews don't matter. Jews don't count, you know, and that's not part of the progressive milieu. So it's this oddly constructed, really, really, again, borrowing, as you say, heavily from Puritanism, but, you know, secular creedal thing that is really, without being hyperbolic, it exercises this really detrimental authority in our culture, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. There was, in my first book, it features a little bit in this book. In my first book, I describe something
unjust, right? Isn't it called unjust?
Yes, unjust, yeah. Social justice and the unmaking of America, that I found that a lot of these activists focus a lot of their attention and indeed hostility and threats, ultimatums on people who otherwise are predisposed to agree with them. They talk, you know, they go after comic book writers and food trucks and, you know, showrunners and people who are otherwise members of good standing with the progressive cultural movement. And why do they do this? Because that's most likely where you're going to generate some traction and demonstrate the efficacy of your movement, because those are the people who are most vulnerable to your particular sort of activism and are most likely to bend over and supplicate before it. If you're focusing all your energies on a hard target and nothing happens and you just slink away after a few days, you don't look like a very effective movement. So you really do have to train your fire on the sort of people who would be predisposed to listen to you. And that's going to be your fellow progressives who are maybe just a tick less zealous in pursuit of the same objectives you're pursuing, and maybe evince slightly less moral zeal in the effort to advance their cause. That's how you demonstrate your effectiveness. Also in the second book is that hierarchy you're talking about, which is the theory of intersectionality.
Right.
The theory of intersectionality posited by Kimberly Williams Crenshaw. Right. Is this idea, it's a very American idea, and I think it's a valuable thought experiment. I don't completely condemn it. I condemn it as a theory of social organization that has some practical application in our politics. But as an academic experiment, I don't see it as totally valueless. It presupposes that individuals have a series of traits, they're composed of a series of traits, and those traits are discriminated against in varying degrees. Mm. So individuals will have varying degrees of discrimination. A Black man, for example, will experience less prejudice than a Black woman because he doesn't experience sexism. An African-American lesbian will get that much more discrimination than an Asian-American gay man, and so on and so forth.
Right.
Again, as a thought experiment, valuable. But because it is very jingoistic, chauvinistic, yeah, it focuses exclusively, almost exclusively on the American experience, that it sees American Jews as very low on that hierarchy. Because in America, unlike every other place on the planet Earth, save one nation, Jews have been very successful. Jews have done very well for themselves. And that's the sort of thing that they see as unearned. Success itself is a function, a very Marxian view of things. Success itself is a function of status and privilege and is therefore undeserved and undue. And that's how you peel away at the idea that American Jews are not a minority class, are not a class that has been discriminated against, has prejudice directed against them. That indeed, if there is prejudice directed against them, it's kind of justified.
Right.
And I think all of that stems back to this hierarchical ideal postulated and promoted by intersectional theorists.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you also, and then, you know, the outgrowth of that would be, you know, the widespread and toxic discrimination against Asian Americans at universities, which is what the court ruled, thankfully, to overturn, you know, because the ideas if Jews and Asians are successful, that then explodes the victim narrative. And if you don't have a victim narrative, you don't have a movement. Right. I mean, if two groups that clearly are not majority groups who through the immigrant experience, through the ethnic experience, through the embrace of the melting pot, all sorts of things, right, come to represent an embrace of the American dream rather than viewing it as some kind of despotism, then you've got a real problem. You have to isolate those groups, right? They have to be downgraded in that woke world's point of view.
I mean, if you're already predisposed to ignore individuality, to right. discredit the idea that individual circumstances have any sort of influence over individual trajectories, career paths, success paths, and you see everybody as a member of a group and indicative indeed of those of their group, of the demography in which they're a member, then yeah, you see disparities in outcomes as being themselves evidence of discrimination. That is essentially the essence of Imram X. Kennedy's theory of anti-racism, that if all of us are equal, then disparate outcomes are a product of prejudice. They can be nothing else.
Right.
And it just,
well, that's another, that's that
individuality actually matters.
Right. Well, that's in the, you know, whole field of which we're not, it's not the subject of our podcast, but it's worth, you know, mentioning sort of like logical fallacies and things that go on of like, you know, oh, you know, there's more men, let's say, in the construction industry than women. Therefore, it is absolute evidence of discrimination against women. No, that is not causality. It is not that your agenda is superseding statistics and data and truth. It's just not the case. There's just more men. Some's going to the
that
cementing
very
of hope.
Observation is what got Larry Summers ejected from the presidency of Harvard, because he said, well, hey, listen, there's not a lot of women in STEM because they don't go into STEM fields. Got him.
I know.
And it's absolutely 100% true, demonstrable. Yeah. And yet it was nevertheless a verboten fact you couldn't give voice to.
Do you think that we are, there is some optimism in me about this, that we have kind of hit a wall with this craziness, this wokeness? Do you think that there is some backlash now occurring to the censoriousness, cancel culture? And I'm kind of throwing it all into one party bag. Are you seeing any, we're going to talk about it. I think Trump both helps and hurts it for various reasons. I wish the Republicans had a mainstream conservative to just say, let's be normal, because they would wipe the floor with the Democrats and win the election. And then we'd be out of this shit. Because Trump also broke the left and made them more insane than I think I ever thought they would be. That doesn't mean he's not insane or fit for office either. It's just, anyway. So where are we at this moment in terms of, if you're taking the temperature, if such a thing is possible, where are the new Puritans?
That's the question I get. That's the question I get more than any other questions. For my first book and my second book, have we reached peak wokeness? And I'm of two minds on the subject, because obviously 2 years have passed since I've been used to get that question in every interview. And you can say there are green shoots that you would like to, you know, latch on to. And you can just as easily find evidence that this philosophy is just getting going and is so intractable, particularly in the fields like academia, where it has a really deep roots, that it's not going anywhere anytime soon. So it depends on the day. I wake up one day and I'll say that this is, you know, the wave of the future, and the next day it's on the outs. It just depends on what we're looking at in the news that particular day. I will say that the seeds of its own destruction, as I said before, are sown in A, you know, the capitalist enterprise, and B, the fact that it is so obsessed with self-policing, that's so insular and sealed. You know, it's this sort of hermetic bubble around the people who are in this particular sort of social class, that it can be isolated. You can go throughout your day, if you live in a field, if you live and work in fields and areas where this is not the predominant view of your neighbors and your colleagues, then you can kind of be isolated from it and not see it as this all-consuming thing. People who are way too online, myself included, are exposed to it on a fairly regular basis, more so than they would be if they were just living their daily lives. So I do think that you can overexpose yourself to this sort of thing and get a distorted view of how influential it actually is. The problem is that they punch way above their weight. The people who are committed to this sort of puritanical revising of the social covenant, they are extremely influential with the people who are influential. So people who are influential in their fields of study, who are influential in their industries, cultural creative industries, and people in politics, and particularly unelected officials, bureaucratic officials, administrative officials, they listen very attentively to who they perceive to be influential, particularly people who are influential online. And those people are disproportionately more inclined towards progressive Puritanism. So it's not as though this is a vast movement that has a lot of subscribers. It's a small movement, but it has the ear of a lot of very influential people. It's part of one of our biggest problems today is a very disproportionately small number of influencers on the right and the left managed to capture the conversation and completely derail it from what the vast majority of Americans actually believe, which is why we have such crazy politics. It's driven by a very small, disproportionate number of people, all of whom are competing with each other to be heard above the din and are getting crazier and crazier as a result, just to make themselves known.
Yeah. Which is a great segue. So on to the subject of your view and conservatism. So you were writing for National Review, founded by the late, great William F. Buckley, who said he would stand athwart history yelling, "Stop!" Tried to, I think, for many years, tell the Birchers and the Kooks and the Cranks to go to the basement or get the hell out, not dominate the discourse, however you want to look at it, for those that like a post-war capsule history of American conservatism. What does it mean today, right, with a Trumpist-led Republican Party to be a conservative? Are you a never-Trumper? Or are you...
So I don't like that label, not because it doesn't describe me, but because it describes a lot of people who I just don't think their views are reflective of my own.
Okay.
A particular sort of Republican who is Republican no longer. I too am not a registered Republican, but they would vote Democratic. And I have no indication that the Democratic Party would ever appeal to me politically.
Were you a registered Republican prior to
I
Trump?
Was for most of my life, from the year my 18th birthday until the year 2016.
Right. Were you raised in a Republican Jewish family?
Well, not Jewish, but yes, Republican. My father is Jewish. His side of the family is agnostic, so I never went to any sort of shul or synagogue. But my mom's side is Irish Catholic. And if your mom is not Jewish, you're not Jewish. So I was just sort of in this spiritual, but not religious household, but Republican for sure. And that was just sort of my background. And then when I went to college, I went there on a theater scholarship, a performing arts scholarship.
Really?
So we had that in common. But then after the September 11th attacks, I was a sophomore in college and I went to work in WABC, which is a news talk radio station in New York City. Right-leaning. I enjoyed the programming and I wanted to get into that field. And I've sort of been in that field ever since. But I've always been more attracted to, when I was that age, I was attracted more to Republicans, qua Republicans, than conservatives. Why? Because conservatives, as I saw them in the late 1990s, early 2000s, did nothing but step all over their own message and trip all over themselves and apply the kind of ideological purity that robbed them of incremental victories and instead transformed them into defeats in the name of ideological purity. And I thought that was so profoundly counterproductive and so stupid that the Republican Party as a vehicle, an enterprise for getting incremental wins and getting politicians elected, whatever they wanted to do, just holding and maintaining power, seemed to me like a pretty valuable enterprise for a political party, which has precisely one job, getting people elected. Nothing else. Doesn't matter what you do when you're elected, just get elected. And then all that seemed to flip on its head with the Trump era, and the Republican Party became less of a vehicle for getting people elected than an ideological purity test. But the ideology changed from conservatism to whatever Donald Trump says in the moment. A lot of people have tried to put meat on those bones. They try to say it's national populism, it's national conservatism, it's whatever Donald Trump says in the moment. And he can say another thing in the next moment, and then the Republican Party will be that. It is unmoored utterly to anything durable, to anything consistent. There is no compass there, moral or otherwise. And that is just something that I just can't get behind. And I understand why other people would, but because they have adopted my view, my erstwhile view of seeing power for power's sake as the sine qua non, they've sort of crystallized for me the error of my ways, because it turns out that getting power for power's sake actually doesn't work, because you don't get either. You get neither ideology, right, ideological consistency, nor power. So it seems to me a rather failed enterprise and an unproductive one.
Yeah. And you're left with, you know, little to no ideology or governing philosophy, because it's cult. Well, first of all, it's cult of personality with Trump. Right. But it's an abandonment in many ways, which I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, of an internationalist commitment to the world stage, to peace through strength, to things like that, that I marvel at, because, you know, I'm born in 1974. And, you know, a lot of the Cold War thinking of, and I was yet very young, but even growing up in the, you know, Reagan and first Bush administration really helped shape the way I see the world, still does. And the idea that people don't understand what providing proper ammunition to Ukraine means in the geopolitical sense. Obviously, the abandonment of Israel, which isn't really happening on the right, that's a left-wing thing. But just the idea that, you know, putting America first, which is not new, by the way, you know, means we're not going to have any foreign aid. I mean, it's so profoundly misguided, and it's unfortunately rooted in making a populace angry domestically and throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And it's so destructive, as you know. What does this mean for a guy like you that, I'm politically homeless. Okay. I'm not a member of a party because I'm a real hybrid. I don't think Joe Biden is evil. I think he's too old, but I don't think he's evil. But I just can't vote for Donald Trump. I just can't do it. It's just a bridge too far.
Yeah. I don't begrudge anybody that. This will be my third consecutive quadrennial election, writing in, I guess, Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney, something like that.
Would that be would you like a Romney or Haley? How about Nikki Haley?
Yeah, she's fine. I mean, she's a very successful politician insofar as she's sort of a shapeshifter. Right. But she's a conservative. I have no doubt that she's a conservative dedicated to conservative principles. She's just a politician who will navigate the environment as best she possibly can. You know, don't put your faith in political actors. But nevertheless, I think she has some principles to her. And among them is the idea that the United States is not the bad guy.
Right.
That is a controversial position on the right.
I know.
That's bizarre. That's where I get off the bus.
Yeah.
As an extroverted presence on the world stage since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there has been no better force for good on the planet Earth than the United States.
Of course. Absolutely.
Capitalism, the capitalist enterprise with the fall of the Berlin Wall, has lifted a billion people out of poverty.
Yep.
Has made wars. We think their wars are worse than they've ever been. They're better than they've ever been.
Yeah.
We have battlefield casualties are lower than they've ever been. That might have changed with the onset of the war in Ukraine, which is a bloody brutal slog. But that's demonstrative of the position I hold, which is that the extroverted presence on the world stage designed to deter near peer competitors like Russia and China from executing the kind of Hobbesian ideal that they would otherwise want, they would otherwise do unimpeded, just impose their will on their neighbors by force. That's how, you know, human society organized itself for generations and generations until the post-war world, when the prohibitive dominance of American power made that an unprofitable project. And that's degrading and eroding before our eyes. And the world that we'll inherit, if that goes away, looks a lot like the attacks of 10/7, for example. Just an absolute brutal, horrible massacre where might makes right. And the only way to effect a political solution to this conundrum is through force and war. And it's horrible. And the idea is to prevent that. And the only way you do that is by raising the stakes, raising the costs for an aggressor past the point at which they're willing to endure them. That's the essence of deterrence. And this seems to be a complicated concept now, all of a sudden, for the right. The left had always had problems with this. Because
always,
they didn't view the United States as the good guy. They viewed the United States through a sort of moral equivalence, a prism that applied a moral equivalence to it, and didn't see a lot of moral distinctions between, I don't know, America and the Soviet Union.
Right.
That was weird. Yeah. And that was stupid.
It was
the sort of thing that made me gravitate towards the Republican Party. And now we see the same moral equivalency applied by really disproportionate and unrepresentative bad actors on the conservative right in the media sphere, media ecosystem, but they're nevertheless extremely influential. They're the loudest members of the party, and they've held the Republican Party in Congress hostage. So you can't say that they're not indicative of a broad strain of philosophy on the right. And I think it has a lot to do with the Trump era. And that's one of the reasons why I've fallen out with this whole enterprise, in part because I think it sacrifices the profoundly valuable US-led global order that our fathers and forefathers and grandfathers before them fought for to bequeath us this great gift, and we are just simply throwing it away. It is so ungrateful, and it's not something that I would be willing to bequeath to my children. I think we should fight for it, and that's what I'm standing up for.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's what's interesting about all the concerns, rightful concerns about Putin's aggression of gobbling up the Baltic states, right, is that a Democratic Party in a different era, not Pat Moynihan and not Scoop Jackson, but going back, you know, basically would refer to the United States, like you said, as this sort of in a morally relativistic way, oh, we're evil, we're imperialists, until you'd be like, really? The Soviet Union has a sphere of influence over half the fucking world, assholes. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? You know, but now the Biden-led Democrat, the mainstream of the Democratic Party, has adopted the idea, not for communist versus capitalist reasons, but for tyranny versus freedom reasons, as a sort of form of the Reagan doctrine that a Putin-led Baltic would destroy NATO and hurt the world and create all sorts of trouble.
And that's what it would be, sort of a threat to the threat that breaks NATO apart. A lot of people think they can't imagine it because they think, well, there's got to be some sort of Soviet style, you know, thousands of forces pouring across the Fulda Gap. No, it's not how it would work anymore. It's just a menace to Estonia. You know, change the facts on the ground really quick, cross-border invasion, say threaten NATO, say, you really want to go, you really want to risk World War III for tiny little Tallinn? You're going to die for Danzig? You know, that sort of thing. And that would break the alliance. And that's the real terrifying fear. Once Article 5 is done, that thing is kaput. But even before, in Democrats in the mid-20th century, back to the Puritan day, back to the Puritan theme, you know, from FDR to JFK, would evoke this sort of providential ideal of America as the fruition of a grand design.
City on a hill.
Correct. I mean, that's Winthrop.
Yep.
And all of it has sort of this congregationalist element to it, which is as puritanical as it gets. And it's sort of messianic, but in a way that I really respond to, as again, we're all inheritors to this tradition. The idea that so many factors have come together to produce this place, this profoundly amazing place. And its greatness is also in its goodness in ways that could not be accidental, that there is some grand hand here at work. That's provincial. That's unsophisticated. That's the sort of talk that you would get from you know, a bumpkin, a rube, who populates the pews on Sundays. That's the sort of thing that's fallen out of favor on the left, and it's fallen out of favor on the right too, an increasingly secular right. But I still believe it, and I still see it, and it's the sort of thing that I'm not ashamed to say, and I don't think Republicans should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have always misunderstood American exceptionalism because I think it's often been but through presidential history, often been colored by kind of a triumphalist rhetoric, which sometimes ignores nuance. However, that's a leader's job as the bully pulpit, so it's a presidential job. But I think it also fell out of favor when the democratization, small d, of news and social media came around, because every problem became paramount. Every issue became seismic. You know, there's no sense of understanding what, you know, people talk about. Millennial and Gen Zs always say, you know, my God, well, how could we be happy about America? Look at how bad we have it. So what do you mean? Look at how bad you have it. My grandfather was in breadlines. He fought the Nazi. I'm just saying, like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, you don't have it. Yes. You know what I mean? No one promised you anything, but at the same time, you only have your own lens, but everything's exacerbated by bad actors online, stupidity, empty rhetoric, and quite frankly, the collapse of I think institutions and associations that kept the country whole. You know, civic, religious, and otherwise. I mean, I think there's something to be said for losing. I think when your religion, and I'm not religious, but I think when your religion becomes me, and I'm going to whine. I think that that has a metastatic way of spreading, and a really awful a way of just kind of consuming a generation of people who don't believe in anything but themselves and their own woes.
I like that. And I agree with that. There's something that you reminded me of, sort of what the evolutionary biology critique of social media, which I think is really interesting. The idea that we are just not evolved. We're not hardwired to be able to comprehend the input that we're getting from so many people with so many radically different social covenants. We are a tribal people evolved to enforce a sort of consistency and homogeneity among our own tribe. And when we're confronted with how everybody else is living and how they're living differently than us and badly, it's a sort of thing that, you know, offends at an elemental level. And so when we're confronted with somebody who's doing something really weird in San Francisco, I live in New Jersey, that shouldn't matter to me at all. No. But it does in a weird way, because I'm confronted with it as though it has invaded my tribe. It has somehow imposed itself on me in ways that I resent. And there's an instinctual desire to enforce a consistency and a homogeneity that we've evolved to impose on our neighbors. I don't know whether that's rooted in science, but I like it.
Well, I mean, I say this all the time, because in these everything's become one large shit show. I think the end of the adage that ruled politics for so long, which essentially rules society, was Tip O'Neill's "All politics is local." And I think the nationalization of politics has been a complete fucking disaster. I think that what is unique about America, which many of its detractors don't want to talk about, is we have this federalist system, right, where there's always a built-in tension between states and localities and the central government, which, again, expanded so inordinately in the 20th century because of the Depression and the war and big government and Roosevelt, you know, but you're supposed to do things closer to home. There's a reason the 10th Amendment is states' rights is in the Bill of Rights. You know, theoretically, you're supposed to have a country that, yes, it's grown exponentially, but we're supposed to not tell the Montana cattle rancher what to do, just as much as a New York liberal shouldn't be told what to do. But everyone's busy, I think, imposing their own will, trying to impose their own will, and superimposing their own beliefs, because everything is shot at you in your face. Oh, my God, there's a racist in Montana. You know, hey, I hate if someone's racist, but you can't legislate it away. Mind your own business. He'll figure it out. Focus on other things. You know, it's stuff like that, you know, or anyway.
No, yeah, and the nationalization of politics and the hijacking of the Republican Party by the online right, unrepresentative online right, has led them down this real cognitive cul-de-sac where it takes a special sort of civic literacy to believe this, but they apparently do that. Really, the only office that matters is the presidency, which is profoundly stupid.
Which is a Democratic Party's problem, too.
It was almost no longer, in part because they've traded coalitions. The Republican coalition was educated, affluent, suburbanite. They turned out for every election. Why? Because they have children, they have jobs, they are stakeholders, they have expectations for the future of their society, and they would show up at special elections, midterm elections, off-year elections, runoff elections. They were there. And those things favored Republicans until about 2006. And then everything began to flip. And now Democrats can count on those voters. Those voters turn out for Democrats in specials, off-years, midterms, runoffs. Now, the idea here is this is going to benefit Republicans in general, presidential elections, because the otherwise tuned-out voter who is so disaffected with society and views America through the lens of 30,000-foot perspective on the whole country, then they turn out for presidential elections, and that's when the GOP benefits. So far, it hasn't worked out that way. But the theory is there that, you know, eventually we'll win the presidency, and maybe the presidency alone. This to me is a profound cul-de-sac. I think it's mostly just a post hoc rationalization.
I do
to try to figure out, like, maybe there was a grand plan behind Donald Trump's fluky personality cult that has taken over the entire Republican Party, and they got to figure out some way to make it make sense. But nevertheless, that's what they've settled on. And it is profoundly stupid.
Yeah. I mean, what's the, I mean, the National Review, I mean, everyone, you don't represent everybody, but would you say you represent the National Review has a sort of prevailing sort of, you know, holding on to a, trying to hold on to a kind of Tory style conservatism that's been somewhat obliterated by Trump?
I think that's fair. Yes. If there was a consensus, and there really isn't, aren't very many. Among our writers, are very diverse staff, and we have you know, debates and discussions, and it's vibrant. It's intellectual.
No, your podcast is great. I love Charlie Cook and all that. It's great. Yeah, no, I do. But I do. No one seems to be Trump standing on there, as far as I know. Is anybody really Trumpy? I haven't heard it.
But there are efforts to be fair,
right,
and to be as representative of the conservative outlook, the modern conservative outlook and Republican outlook as possible. There are others who are more predisposed to him than some, and vice versa. Trump really isn't, I mean, the personality isn't as important as the ideas. We like to litigate ideas.
Yes.
I mean, it depends on who you're talking about, but if there was one thing that we all kind of subscribe to, I think it is that it is the loyal opposition, the idea that America isn't finished if you didn't win an election, and that everything's going to hell and there's nothing good, and no, conservatism hasn't conserved anything. And we're all, you know, on this train to this unmovable force towards, you know, utter damnation. That sort of fatalism, that catastrophism, again, is a post hoc rationalization just designed to justify all the moral compromises you make along the way. And yeah, I think we do reject that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that also fell out of fashion, I mean, George W. Bush tried to do it sort of with a compassionate conservatism, but the Iraq War was such a disaster for so many reasons that it I think became really problematic. But going back further, you know, the thing about Ronald Reagan and that brand of, and that era, right, was that there was, that conservatism could have a sunny face. And it always makes me think of, you know, a real acolyte, Jack Kemp, you know, a guy I always admired, because Jack Kemp could go with a smile to the inner city and talk about empowerment zones and capitalism and free markets, while also, well, without a hint of racism, without a hint of condescension, you know, and he could sell a kind of inspired vision, the kind of party of ideas, which it was, you know, an antidote to a kind of decrepit 60s and 70s liberalism and high taxation, you know, all the things Reagan came to represent at home and abroad.
And then we have if there's very few signs of hope, so I latch on to whatever I can find. And one of them is the ascension of Argentinian President Javier Milei, who sounds
he's great.
Like
he balanced
Friedman.
The budget. Right. He sounded balanced the budget days. 12 weeks, 12 days. Right.
with profound pain involved. And that is just the nature of anti-inflationary programs. I mean, the economist Jeff Sachs, who has turned against all his own work, was the author of something called Shock Therapy, which is what brought Bolivia back from the brink. And it hurts a lot. That's the whole point of it, is the restoration of price stability is a painful exercise, because you got to make everything really expensive for a little bit. But his assumption of this sort of free marketeering, unapologetic, really bold-faced attacks on statism and a socialist ideal of communitarianism and the pursuit of power for power's sake in order to better the world, but then it just becomes a justification for your own assumption of power because you fancy yourself the indispensable man. All this stuff is the sort of Jack Kempian, Reaganite view that was really native to the conservative movement, I should say, but the conservative movement when it had assumed the reins of the Republican Party. And he's going to speak at CPAC, I think this weekend. And he should deliver exactly, word for word, the speech he gave to Davos to CPAC. It all is applicable. These people fancy themselves not the masters of the universe, but certainly the masters of their movement. They are communitarian. They are power for power's sake. They have sacrificed free market ideas in the pursuit of something far, far more collectivist. I hope, and Javier Milei is being embraced by people like Marco Rubio, who was once a free marketeer himself and his fancies himself now the an advocate for national conservative industrial policy, whatever that means. There's no meat on those bones, but it's vogue. And he should go there, and he's getting an audience with these people, and he should use his platform to remind them, just, you know, serve as the ghost of Christmas past and remind them of who they were and who they aspired to be, because boy, do they need it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, the Melee story. I was I'm originally from Miami, and I went home for Thanksgiving, and a guy to pick me up, and the car service I used down there is Argentinian, and it was right before the election. He was talking about how his family lives half the year in Argentina, has just been, everyone's been suffering so terribly under the failed policies of the past, and how they all want Melee. And I was telling this to a progressive friend of mine, who I do ideological battle with quite frequently, but I adore him. And I said, this is what I've heard. He goes, oh, you're listening to your driver? He's just a Malay. Oh, he's just another Trump. I mean, that's the kind of attitude that prevails. And I said to this person, I said, let me stop you. I said, your whole thing in life is the common man and looking out for people and all the thing, which, and I'm saying, here's somebody who tells you in a country you've never been to, what they're living with was 246% inflation and complete failure of statist policies. But you are so in a bubble that A, you're condescending to the driver, but B, you don't even want to hear about it. I said, do you understand why people hate the left? Because you guys are such, I said this, you guys are such assholes. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, I always say this. Hey, I think there's a lot of
ending. Yeah.
Yes. Listen, I think there's a lot of assholes on the right. We're equal opportunity offenders here. I'm not just beating. But when I hear people talk like that, they don't even live there. MSNBC's told them he's Trump 2.0 or Trump Latin America or Bolsonaro, all of which isn't true. But it's okay. They've decided to adopt it. They read it in the New York Times and life goes on. It's just, but that is.
Well, if they read it in the New York Times, then they clearly don't read Tom Friedman. Because if we're going to indict cab driver wisdom, yeah, you're going to indict every Tom Friedman column.
Probably they don't. I mean, that's true. That's true. My point is that they're getting their fast food little bite, you know, from wherever their algorithm spits it out. And they already had a decision on something they didn't know anything about.
But again, chauvinistic, jingoistic, this idea that everything has to be the filtered through the American experience, that this guy's got to be a Trump of some sorts. And we went through that throughout the Trump era. This is the Trump of, they did that to Italian prime minister. I forget her name, Giorgia Meloni.
Where she
was described as, you know, sort of a fascist wannabe. Her party had some background in fascist politics, and she was assumed to be very like Trump, and therefore pro-Russia. Therefore, it was going to break the NATO alliance, and she was going to be essentially an Orban in Italy. And she's been anything but. Hmm. But because of this Trumpian framework, like Bolsonaro, Orban, they do kind of fit those molds. But you wouldn't know that until you actually studied them. And if you study their economic prescriptions, you would know they have no resemblance to what Javier Milei is advocating. They're far more collectivist, far more statist, and industrial policy advocates. But it's the sort of thing that you would only come to if you apply this heuristic of the American experience and impose it on foreign affairs. We didn't talk about Israel very much, but that
we're going to.
That yes. happens to Israel too. Particularly when it comes to those Americans who were seduced by the Black Lives Matter movement.
The grafting of race relations onto the Palestinian cause.
They map American racial experience onto this conflict that they do not otherwise understand in order to understand it. And that it leads them to cognitive cul-de-sacs from which they can't escape, apparently. It seems to be a trap from which you can't emerge. But it is a completely erroneous way to look at this conflict.
Yeah, and it's, well, there are unfortunate historical roots to it. You know, the third world collective linking of Pan-African movements with left wing, the new left in the 1960s in America with Black
Lumumba
Panthers.
University.
Right. With Lumumba, with, you know, and then Franz Fanon's colonial stuff. I mean, all of this, there's a lot of stuff that,
and
you know,
Soviet
that. Well, that's what I say. So I wrote a piece about the UN's anti-Semitic problem and talked a lot about the Zionism versus racism stuff. And on my Substack, and a lot of people, I got a lot of great response. Like, wow, I didn't know the Soviet Union really midwifed the PLO. I'm like, yes, Arafat was Egyptian. He's not Palestinian. He was actually trained by the Soviets in propaganda. It's just true. This is a little bit like stuff that you might have said 50 years ago, and you'd be laughed off the stage. Hey, Alger Hiss was a communist, as it happens, by the way. We now know that. You know, Nixon was smeared for it, but he was right. He was spying on his own country on behalf of our mortal enemy. So again, you know, Mahmoud these things.
Abbas, who's the head of the Palestinian Authority, got his doctorate from Patrice Lumumba University in the Soviet Union in anti-Semitism. I mean, they called it something different, but it was like an anti-Jewish ideal.
And right.
That's where the post-colonial project emerges.
Absolutely. By the way, the Soviet Union PLO relationship or the Palestinian resistance movement were nothing if not the most useful idiots for the Soviets. I mean, they were targeted as such, and they were easily subverted ideologically and transformed by it. Just the way it was. By the way, the Soviet controlled the third world bloc in the UN. And, you know, and when, by the way, when Egypt decided it was going to bow out and not be Israel's mortal enemy anymore, they found somebody else. That's where Arafat stepped in and the PLO grew. And it's all, you know, you go back to the 60s with the Arab League conference. I mean, there's a lot of history to this that I love that, you know, has always shaped my worldview as a Zionist. And nothing has been more heartbreaking to see though I'm not surprised by the outpouring. I shouldn't say the outpouring, the outbreak of this kind of virulent anti-Semitism coming from the left. I mean, they've completely become or always have been and showed their true colors hostile to Jews. It's not just Israel, it's to Jews. And I think those things are interchangeable. But you know what I mean? It's been I'm sure you've written about it forever. And I've been on fire about it, especially since October 7th. The people I see post things all the time. You name a disenfranchised group, they'll post about it. All they've ever posted about now, not all everybody, but I see people always saying, oh, we have to have peace and we have to Jews in Palestine. You know, they never sort of come at you and say, wow, you know, these Jewish women were really raped and had body parts cut off. You know, they don't go into
that's
that. Some
thing. I mean, yeah. So a lot of well-meaning, I think people who, if the polls are correct, a lot of Americans would agree with the statement, you know, anodyne statements like, well, maybe this war has gone a little too far. It's kind of uncomfortable with it. But if you ask them, well, should Hamas remain the governing authority in Gaza? They say, oh, no, God, no.
Right.
But that's what you're advocating. If you're saying, you got to stop now before Israel's completed its objective, which is the neutralization of Hamas as a threat, then you're saying, well, we got to keep Hamas around. And people don't actually subscribe to that. When you confront them with the consequences of their own advocacy, they kind of get uncomfortable with it. It's just an expression of an aphorism, a sentiment, which is like, everybody should get together and be happy, right? We shouldn't be shooting at each other. And then that's the sort of thing that is very shallow, sure, but understandable as a human, as an aspirational sentiment, as a human emotion. It's great. But nevertheless, what you're advocating for with your pacifism is murder, is terrorism, is rape, mm-hmm. is immolation, mm-hmm. Is exactly what we saw in 10/7. And there will be more because these people have said they want to do more. They won't stop. This is an existential conflict. And if you have an interest in one side existing, then you must side with the side you're on.
Well, if you are part of a culture or a way of thinking that's been shaped through a professoriate that's anti-Israel, through a culture that is, through political movements which have made Jews or cast Jews as the oppressors, you're right. Then you people go into a cul-de-sac. They get very confused. They don't know what to do. They want to stand with Palestine, but they don't want to be anti-Semitic, but they don't know what Palestine is. They don't, you know, they don't even know what it is. They think that Israel's controlled Gaza, you know, all this time. And they don't know. I mean, they really know very little. All of that is to not excuse anything, though, because it's like when you see neo-Nazis marching, you know, the common refrain is, well, they're just ignorant. Well, so are college students. I don't think everybody on that college campus is a dedicated anti-Semite, but I think if they're going to carry banners, say from the river to the sea, and chant, you know, things that put Jews in harm's way, well, then they're equally culpable. I mean, how is it this any different? I mean, right? They're ignorant, you know. And but if you bring up that's just ignorant. They're just so racist and ignorant. Well, you know, a lot of your overeducated fools are anti-Semitic and ignorant. Well, by dint of what they're doing. I mean, how is there? The thing about our political discourse too is the thing that drives me crazy is everybody who uses like a both sides whataboutism to close down arguments. Just because one side could be worse than the other doesn't mean the other side is not menacing. I mean, asymmetry doesn't imply, you know, irrelevance. I mean, you know, we can't, and everything becomes, well, you know, Trump did that. I'm like, I didn't say he didn't. I'm just saying the Democrats shouldn't be doing this. It's just, you know, very difficult to, as you and I, you know, have to wade through the world we're in.
Well, we're ejected from our respective tribes, and back to the evolutionary biology thing. That's a discomforting experience. Nobody likes to be in that place. We're hardwired to be tribal, to be a part of a group that defines itself in opposition to other groups. It's part of how you establish a tribal identity, not just what you guys like, but what you like and they don't. And that makes them the bad tribe. This is all hardwired into how we evolved in this planet. So when you're ejected from that sort of circumstance, first of all, your desire is to find another tribe. But secondly, it's just a very disorienting experience, and it's not one that's fun or pleasant or enjoyable. And the people like us who end up scolding everybody around them, you know, we're probably not very fun people to be around in the long run, because everybody wants to belong and we don't belong. And we're telling other people that maybe you shouldn't belong too. I mean, that's heretical. It's apostasy.
Which is even worse, right? It's apostasy, not welcome in the Puritan world, as you're right about, and not welcome in the woke world. But before we go, the Trump Biden. So we're in another election with this, another rematch between two people America doesn't want. What happens? What I want to do? Come on, we've plumbed the depths of Puritan philosophy and internationalism and Wilsonian thought here.
Now we descend back.
Yes, let's get back to let's do some brass tacks. It's after dark. Where are we at?
So I think Donald Trump has a real uphill battle here. I don't care what the polls say.
I agree with you. Yeah.
He's got to do one of two things, both of which are very, very difficult. One is to convince reliable high proclivity voters who turned out in 2020 to vote against him to vote for him. Huge psychological hurdle. Once you've cast your vote against somebody, it's really hard to convince them to cast your vote for that person.
Right.
So let's take that one off the table. The other option is to remake the electorate, to drive out a whole bunch of voters who don't normally turn out, like we said, low propensity voters who would otherwise turn out only in presidential elections, because otherwise they don't pay attention. And they're very disaffected from the political world. They don't like the American system. They don't feel like they benefit from it. They're hostile to the American social compact. So they're unreliable voters. But are they really going to turn out for Donald Trump like they did in 2016? In 2016, he remade the electorate because he was very much an outsider candidate. He was the candidate for people who were disaffected with the system. He's the establishmentarian candidate now. He's the incumbent president from the Republican Party, the establishment choice. The campaign committees are rallying around him. The entire party has anointed him and endorsed him. So he's far more establishmentarian than I think that kind of voter would be enthused to vote for. If that kind of voter turns out, is he going to turn out for Donald Trump or maybe RFK Jr., who's on the ballot, who's really the anti-establishmentarian, the really shake things up kind of guy? So that's his biggest problem. And I don't think it's surmountable. Joe Biden's problems are just as ingrained, just as problematic for him. But I think he has an easier job reassembling something like his coalition because his voters don't really have anywhere else to go, especially the people who are really registering their dissatisfaction now with Joe Biden, primarily due to his support for Israel and its existential war of defense against Hamas. Those voters are irritated with Joe Biden.
Let's see if they defend.
Are they really going after $1 billion is spent after a highly polarizing general election campaign? Are they? Yeah. They may not vote, but they're not going to go to the other guy. And I suspect they mostly vote. I think Donald Trump can probably win back Georgia. But is Joe Biden going to lose Michigan? Maybe, but I kind of doubt it. I mean, I was playing with the electoral map today. Like if Donald Trump won back, for example, Georgia, and Joe Biden narrowly won Michigan, and Donald Trump won Pennsylvania, you could get a really fun 269-269 tie, which is the worst possible scenario. And then it goes to the House, and the House has a majority of Republican state delegation, so they choose the president, and the Democratic Senate would choose the vice president. It would be very 18th century, which is what we should get, actually, for having two consecutive one-term presidents. That's really antebellum for you.
Yes.
But you know, we're in uncharted territory. How do I know? This is a terrible set of circumstances this country is in.
No,
we have the worst possible representatives of our republic vying to lead this place. Nobody likes these people. The people who do like these people are wildly unrepresentative of the American electorate. Like it's 70-30 at best, 70-20 proposition most likely. that people, that Americans do not want to see ourselves in this position, and they profoundly resent it. And that's a slow ticking poison.
It is.
We'll get through this election, but they won't forget it. They won't forget the resentment. And I think after this election, somebody somewhere who's got the stones to do it needs to mount a campaign to reform the primary process, because this country is hostage to the most unrepresentative, extremely zealous members of the political class whose outlook, whose proclivities, whose priorities are not representative of their neighbors. And there needs to be some effort to make these parties more representative of the country they're supposed to lead. Because otherwise, I don't see this experiment perpetuating itself. The American people aren't going to sit back and be led by people who don't represent them forever. There's going to be a revolt, and hopefully that manifests in something healthy, like a candidacy that from a third-party candidacy that is supposedly representative of the broad middle, although that's even harder to believe. But this, something's got to break here, because we just can't keep doing this. The parties keep choosing for themselves the worst possible representatives to represent their outlook, their point of view. Mostly, I think, because they're the worst possible representatives, that primary voters get a little jazz out of really irritating people, especially people who they regard as more representative of a broad, milquetoasty sort of centrist outlook, which, by the way, describes most people. But they like pissing those people off. Democratic primary voters, Republican primary voters, they really like pissing people off. That is the highest emotional satisfaction they get out of voting. And it's extremely unhealthy, and it cannot last.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the binary nature of our politics obscures, I think, what most people feel, to your point. I mean, this podcast was created as a middle lane for people that have, who could be never Trump or always democracy, or, are very discontented, but also are full of nuance and full of contradictions, and that, as we all are. Walt Whitman said, I contain multitudes, I mean, but in a sense of like, I'm going to vote for Joe Biden, but Democratic operatives think that that's proof that he is the right way to go and I'm happy. That's not what that means. It means with two choices, I'm going to take that option. That's just me. That's what I did in 2020. That does not mean I'm happy. I'm really not happy. But they view that as, see, well, you're, an independent and you've got center right tenants. I said, yeah, but I don't want Donald Trump to be president. Trust me, if Nikki Haley or Chris Christie had been the nominee, I would have voted for them. I mean, hands down. So I said, you're barking up the wrong tree. Now, I'm not in Michigan or Pennsylvania. I live in California, but a lot of people think like me. Abortion rights may save you. Trump may overstay, his conviction of something could sink him, but something could happen to Joe Biden too.
We've talked a lot about how Republicans are in trouble. Democrats are in huge trouble. Huge trouble.
Yeah.
They have created for themselves the most unstable coalition of voters I've seen in my lifetime.
Oh, yeah. And they're losing the Black and Latino working class.
Because what they're losing are people who don't have degrees across the board.
Yep.
Whatever your demography.
That's
if you're
it.
Not a degree holder, you're increasingly alienated from this party.
Right.
And that is so just demographically stupid. It's shocking. The math doesn't make sense. There are not enough degree holders in this country for that to be a winning coalition. And is there any doubt, as you said, the polling's pretty clear. If all of a sudden Republicans woke up tomorrow and decided to nominate Nikki Haley, the entire Democratic Party would implode on itself. The whole coalition would just explode out, and some would go to Republicans, some would go independent. Yes. But it would,
and she would win. And I keep saying she won't. Win. She would absolutely win.
Oh, it would be an epochal electoral event.
We wouldn't have seen. We haven't seen big electoral wins really since, I guess, Obama in 2008, or even you go back even to Bill Clinton, or to these sort of, big wins of.
The best Joe Biden can hope for is sort of a narrow, squeak it out election strategy, and that seems to be the what Democrats have decided is the best they could possibly hope for. Talk about a defeatist outlook. They too are just as hostage to a very unrepresentative voting base as Republicans are.
No, they are. Well, and as you point out in your wonderful book, they have to contend with the new Puritans, who are loud, just as much as the MAGA America First, I call America Last people really are a loud voice. You know, they alienating everybody. But the question is, if progressives are killing fun, as you say, and I think there's so much about the book that's serious, but also very tongue in cheek in some of your examples, progressives are killing fun. At the end of the day, this is what a friend of mine said, and we'll close on this. Nobody wants to live in a world where every move you make, every piece of cuisine you eat, every hat you wear is held to a standard of judgment and condemnation. Nobody wants to live in that world, you know, and that's what people hate. It's not that the majority of us want to run around being, ravaging nutcase racists or be insensitive to anybody. We just don't want to live in a world where we can't breathe or feel, or, you know, we're one step away from censorious.
I mean, that is part of the problem with making a coalition out of people who are degree holders, especially right. If you've gotten this degree within this century.
Right.
We've been taught that you need to deconstruct your environment as you would a piece of legislation right. Or a dissertation. You don't. It makes you obnoxious. It makes you utterly impossible to be around. And yep. In fact, you are trying to impose your misery on the people in your surroundings. It's not a healthy outlook, and it's definitely not one that's going to be long-lived.
No, and you know what? As I always say, I think human nature sucks, and that's what always keeps me – that's what also animates whatever conservative small C impulse I have, because I know there's no perfectibility to it. So let's stop trying to pretend there is, and socially engineering nonsense. It's a doomsday proposition. It's bad for the country. I think it's bad for us. But Noah Rothman is good for the country and good for us. His book, The Rise of the New Puritans – Fighting Back Against Progressives, A War on Fun. It came out in 2022, but if you haven't read it, take your time in reading it. I actually read it over 3 days because there was a lot to marinate. Noah, this has been a freewheeling, very, very enlightening conversation. Exactly what After Dark's supposed to be. We were sans drink, but we're going to have you back for another edition later in the day when you can have your proper whatever you drink.
I will come prepared with the... A really barrely Cabernet, I think.
Oh, a barrely. There you go.
That's where I go.
All right. Speaking my language. Big, bold,
there you go. Red. Big, bold red.
Okay. Noah, stick around with us. But thanks for listening, guys. As always, we are your political port in this crazy, tempestuous storm. Stay dirty, stay moderate, and stay safe.